The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will start the tax committee. We'll officially call it to order when we have a quorum, and we will break into any discussions or anything once we do have a quorum to officially convene here. At that point, we will do some housekeeping issues. We will please take a look at the minutes, members, so that we can approve those. We also have a couple bills in a bit here that will move to the property tax division. So those are the things we'll be doing. But today we're going to be going over some overviews with nonpartisan House research. And this is kind of a tradition. We kind of do this every year, not necessarily for the Representative Carlson's and the Representative Loon's and others, and Barrett's have been here for a while. I think we're pretty familiar with the crack staff we have at House Research. But we do want to go over what they can do, what they can't do, what different areas they have, so we know. And members of this committee, I would suggest that you use research. They're very good. They will get you accurate information on a timely basis. I would also, so let's start with that. I will interrupt for a few housekeeping details once we actually have a quorum. So, Mr. Hines, are you starting us off here, or who's starting off here? Ms. Manzi? Oh, Mr. Yeah. Michael. Oh, yeah. He's with House Research. Mr. Michael, if you could please start, and with the understanding that I will be interrupting once we have a quorum.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joel Michael from House Research. What we're going to do, and I'm not going to start, that's why I'm sitting here in my more usual place, but we're going to go through basically a very quick overview of state taxes today. In the property tax division that just adjourned previously, we went through property taxes. But before we actually get into the subject matter, within your packet there is a sheet, as the chair pointed out. This sheet, which is a big four-column table, lists the subject areas that the committee covers. And then on the left column and in the middle column, it lists the House Research staff person who's the primary person to call, and the House Research backup if you can't get a hold of that person, and then on the far right column, the fiscal analyst to call. And don't be intimidated by this. If you don't know who to call, just call any one of us and we'll send you off to the right person if we're not the right person. So with that, I'll turn it over to, I think Ms. Templin's going to start with going over with an overview of state tax revenue.
Okay, and thank you very much, Mr. Michael. We'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order as we do have a quorum. A couple things. I will be interrupting one more time when Mr. Rubis gets back, the committee minister gets back. He's going to have a couple bills that we want to make sure that gets done. So that'll be one thing that we will look at. Representative Ann Sills moves the minutes of our first meeting, the minutes of January 13th. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ann Sells. Okay, one other announcement I would like to make before we go to House Fiscal with Ms. Templin is we don't have any rules, but one procedure we do follow in this committee is as bills come up and as you're bringing folks in from Duluth or north of that or anywhere south, Owatonna, whatever, one thing that we do in this committee is we run out of time sometimes. And so if you have someone here for a bill, please notify Mr. Rubis or the committee legislative assistant and let them know that you have somebody from your district. I have a 50-mile rule. If you're more than 50 miles, we want to get you that date, even if we don't finish the bill that day. So if Representative Simonson has somebody from the Lincoln Park neighborhood, we do want to get them on the record, even if it's kind of out of order of things. So that's one rule that we unofficially, I guess, have. It's just kind of a courtesy thing to be able to get folks that have made the effort to get down here. And then, of course, we can always go to another meeting, and we'll have the roadies and groupies do their thing for that. Okay, so Ms. Templin, if you could please start with House Fiscal Analyst, please introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Analysis Department. There's 60-plus slides, so I am going to cover the tax revenues and the incident slides fairly quickly. If at any point you don't, if you need more information, please stop me. I'm starting with slide two, state tax revenues. This shows a projection of fiscal 15 projected revenues for the state of Minnesota from the general fund and non-general fund sources. The total is about $22 billion. As you can see from the slide, the largest share, the largest slice of the pie is individual income taxes at 45% of the total, which represents about $10 billion. The next largest slice is sales tax at $6.2 billion and $6 billion for all other taxes. Moving along.
Mr. Chair, I'll do this second slide, and then we'll go back to Cynthia.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Manson. Before we do that, we're going to move some bills over because otherwise I'll forget. I will move over House File 135, a Pepin bill on Municipal Fiscal Disparities Contribution Limited, and House File 140, a Carlson bill, additional property tax refund modified. So I'm moving those two, just so members know, those two are going over to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. Please introduce yourself for the tape. This isn't a tape. What do we call these things these days?
Record.
For the record. For the record. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. I want to note that there's should be a copy of the presentation in your packet. There should also be a longer Word document titled Overview of Income, Sales, and so forth. That one will have more detail in it if we're talking about something in a big picture way and you want to see more about it. Please look in the larger document. Both of these documents will be posted to our website later this week or early next week. Typically, when we give these presentations, we come across some typos and things in them, and we try to update those and correct them before we post the documents to our website. So if you're looking for it electronically, just be patient, and it'll be there soon.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Manzi.
Individual income tax is collected through withholding and estimated payments throughout the tax year, and then people make a final payment or receive a refund when they file their return during the filing season. Tax year 14 returns, the filing season will be opening next week, as you heard from the Commissioner of Revenue yesterday. Final payments will be due by April 15th of 2015. Income tax revenue, as Ms. Templin noted, is projected to be about $10 billion for fiscal year 15. There is no reciprocity with Wisconsin in effect at this time. It's about 45% of general funds, of total state tax revenue, and all of it goes to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, the next slide shows income tax revenues from fiscal 2005 to 2015. As I mentioned earlier, it represents 45% of the total state budget. And I should also note that individual income tax, 100% of it goes into the general fund. In fiscal 15, again, about $10 billion is projected to go into the general fund. In this slide also, you can see the downturn in the economy in about fiscal 2008. Mr. Chair, the next slide is, on slide six, is a tax incident slide. And I'm going to go through these fairly quickly because this data is going to be updated by the Minnesota Department of Revenue in March of this year. This data, incidence data, shows the burden of the individual income tax, the state individual income tax, across Minnesota households. For this presentation, we grouped what is the deciles into quintiles of taxpayer information. And we did that for simplicity and for presentation purposes. So the data is collapsed into quintiles. This slide shows the effective individual income tax rates, which is the ratio of income tax paid to household income. As you can see, the tax burden rises from negative 0.9% of total income for the poorest fifth of Minnesota households to 4.9% of income for the richest fifth of Minnesota households. And it is 5.6% for the richest 1% of Minnesota households. And this is what economists would describe the income tax system as progressive. For just going back quickly, if you're interested in what the quintiles and what the household income is for those quintiles, just cross-reference this document, and on page 4, it shows what those quintiles are for these slides. And just another piece of information, household income is defined as taxable and non-taxable income. And there is a much better definition of that on page 81 of the tax incidence report that is published. This is the 2013 version, and again, it will be updated in March of this year. The next slide is pretty self-explanatory. It shows the individual income tax, the share of individual income taxes paid as a percent of the total by quintiles. And as you can see, the fifth decile pays in the largest share of the total of individual income taxes at 73.7%.
Mr. Chair, now I'm going to give a big picture overview of how the income tax works.
Ms. Massey?
The income tax, we have a tax base. To that tax base, there are tax rates applied. That gets you to what I'm going to call a preliminary tax. Then we allow various credits. Those credits are applied against the preliminary tax, and then the individual filer arrives at their final tax. This structure poses various choices for legislators in designing the tax. The first of those is which tax base to use, which tax rates to use, and what credits to allow. Our tax base under current law is federal taxable income. To that, we add various items, which we call Minnesota additions, various other items of income that we subject to tax, which the federal government does not. Then there are subtracted from that Minnesota subtractions, which are items that we do not tax, which the federal government does. So the tax base poses some choices for legislators. The first of these is if we're going to continue to conform to federal taxable income. We could use a different base. We could use federal adjusted gross income. We could design our own base. There are various advantages to conforming, some of which the commissioner shared with you yesterday. The next question is, what additions to taxable income are we going to require? And then what subtractions are we going to allow? There are some subtractions that the state doesn't have a choice about. There are a handful of subtractions that are mandated by federal law. So our current tax base of federal taxable income is federal adjusted gross income minus either the standard deduction allowed at the federal level or a bundle of itemized deductions, and then minus personal and dependent exemptions. There are itemized deductions for property taxes paid, for mortgage interest paid, charitable contributions, and some miscellaneous job expenses and a handful of other things. If any of you file your own taxes, these itemized deductions will be on Schedule A of the federal tax return. The standard deduction for tax year 2015 is $12,600 for a married couple filing jointly. Half of that, $6,300 for a single filer or a married couple filing separately, and $9,250 for a head of household filer. We recently conformed to a permanent change in federal law that made the standard deduction for married joint filers two times the standard deduction for single filers, which reduced the marriage penalty in the federal income tax. When we saw the federal conformity bill yesterday in committee, some of you who have been here before may have noticed that the revenue impact of it was substantially smaller than federal conformity bills we've seen in past years. One of the reasons for that is that the previous federal tax bill made a number of changes to the federal law permanent, and Minnesota conformed to them on a permanent basis. Among those changes was that increase in the standard deduction for married filers. Let's see, the other piece that people get to subtract from their federal adjusted gross income is the personal or dependent exemptions. For tax year 15, that's $4,000 for each person in the household. So with a $12,600 standard deduction and a $4,000 personal independent exemption, you can see that your total income, your adjusted gross income, gets reduced quite a bit before you get to your federal taxable income, even for a family that claims the standard deduction. For a family who claims itemized deductions and is paying mortgage interest, is paying property taxes, making a lot of charitable contributions, their federal taxable income will be even smaller relative to their adjusted gross income. So in the income tax, when we think of what your income is, well, there's what your income is to start with, which is sort of how much you make in your wages or self-employment income, dividends, interest, capital gains, and so forth, and then what you're really taxed on, which will be some smaller amount after your deductions and exemptions. So we have choices again relative to our tax base. As you heard yesterday, this new federal law, the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014, changed the definition of federal taxable income and adjusted gross income, and did so retroactively for tax year 14. In doing this, it extended various deductions, and it changed the rules for depreciation and expensing of some items. If the state goes on to conform, it will simplify compliance for taxpayers and administration for the Department of Revenue. If we don't conform, it will require modifications to tax year 2014 forms, and the filing for 2014 returns, as the commissioner reported yesterday, will begin next week. So if we don't conform, as she shared with you, then Minnesota will have to devise this new form called the M1NC, which people will have to comply with in filing their returns for last year. Now, we've gotten past tax base, so what are the additions to taxable income? First among these is the interest on other states' bond issuances that people hold. The federal government exempts from tax state and local bond interest. Minnesota exempts Minnesota bond interest, but we require people to add to taxable income interest they pay on bonds from other states and local governments in other states. In some years, we also have additions for federal changes that we haven't conformed to. Many of you remember the addition for the additional standard deduction amount for married joint filers. Since we conform to that permanently, we don't have that addition anymore. If we conform to tax year 14, then we won't have any of these additions for tax year 14. Congress hasn't made any changes to federal taxable income for tax years after 2014, so right now we're in conformity for 2015 and going forward. The next thing are the things that we're going to allow as subtractions. Three of these are required as federal law. U.S. bond interest. The states are not allowed to tax U.S. bond interest. States are not allowed to tax railroad retirement benefits or the on-reservation earnings of members of Indian tribes. Then there are some subtractions that we have due to having not conformed to past federal changes to taxable income. These all relate to timing issues. So we allow different amounts. We have a different scheme for dealing with Section 179 expensing and for bonus depreciation, which we discussed yesterday. And we also have a different scheme from that for net operating losses, where in the last couple, not this tax bill, but the previous federal tax bills, the federal government allowed carrybacks farther for net operating losses than Minnesota did. So those get tracked differently for affected taxpayers out until the loss is fully used up. Then we finally get to subtractions that are discretionary items at the state level. And these are things that past legislatures have chosen to allow as subtractions to taxable income. There's a subtraction for K-12 education expenses, including tuition paid to non-public schools. There's a subtraction for charitable contributions made by people who don't itemize deductions. This subtraction is limited to 50% of the amount of contributions over $500 in a year. There are subtractions for all military pay, both full-time military members and National Guard and reservists. This is pay for current service. This is not for military retirement pay. There is a subtraction for low-income elderly filers, a subtraction for income in job Z zones, and for organ donation expenses of people who choose to donate organs for transplant. There are a few other smaller subtractions that are listed in the longer document if you want to take a look at that. So now we've made our additions to taxable income, we've made our subtractions for taxable income, and we've gotten to Minnesota taxable income. And the next step is to apply our tax rates to that. As Ms. Templin noted, we have a progressive income tax that's demonstrated by our four-rate structure. We have four rates. The lowest is 5.35%. The highest is 9.85%. The 5.35% rate applies to the first $36,650 of income for a married joint couple, regardless of how much income you have. So everyone just pays 5.35% on the first $36,650. The next rate applies to income from just above that up to just over $145,000. Then the 7.85% applies, whoops, we've got a typo here. As I said, we would find typos, so there's one here. That this next rate is going to go up to $258,000. I'll have to see whether it's really at the 145 or the 140, but it's in that neighborhood. And then finally, we have the 9.85% rate applying to taxable income over $258,260. All of these brackets are adjusted each year for inflation. This is what gives us the progressive tax distribution that Ms. Templin talked about in the, and demonstrated with the slides of the incidence report. This in combination with exemptions and deductions, which reduces everyone's income. So now we've gotten to tax liability, and the next step is to apply the credits that we allow at the state level. These are things that we choose to allow as credits. We have both non-refundable credits. A non-refundable credit can offset a taxpayer's liability, but that's it. So if you have $1,000 of tax liability and you qualify for a $1,500 non-refundable credit, it will reduce your tax to zero. And then the other $500 of credit that you qualify for is just gone away. You don't get that $500. You just get your tax reduced to zero. If you have a refundable credit in the same situation, then you will get a refund check from the state for the $500. We have five non-refundable credits in effect for tax year 15 and eight refundable credits for tax year 15. The first credit is generally considered to be a basic feature of the tax. It's the credit for taxes paid to other states for people who have income in more than one state. These individuals calculate their Minnesota tax on all their income, including the amount that's earned in another state. And then they do that, they will have to do that in the other state also, and the credit we allow equals the tax that they paid in the other state. This credit is, it's not projected. It's projected as a feature of the income tax, but it's not forecast separately. So the most recent data we have for it is the actual amount for tax year 2012, which is just over $200 million. The next credit, non-refundable credit, is called the marriage penalty credit or the marriage credit. This credit is intended to offset the marriage penalty in our progressive rate and bracket structure for income that is earned by each spouse. And in that earned income definition, we include wages and we include Social Security and retirement income that's particular to each spouse. That, you know, each spouse may have had a job and has a pension and has their own Social Security. There's a formula that it goes through that compares the tax they would have paid as single people on their earned income with the tax that they pay as a married couple filing jointly. And this credit equals the difference between the two. The maximum credit will change from year to year because the income tax brackets are increased each year for inflation. The maximum for this tax year 15, is just under $1,400, and this credit is just over $80 million for fiscal year 15. And I see there's a question.
Oh, I don't see.
Oh, there isn't. Okay, there was just a wave.
You got one here.
What would you prefer? Would you prefer that we ask questions as we go, or do you want to get to a point, stop, and then ask questions? What's best for you?
Mr. Chair, I think as we go would be fine.
Okay, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Manzi. I just wanted to confirm that I heard correctly when you were discussing the Minnesota subtractions and the K-12 education expenses. Mm-hmm. I think I heard you say that includes tuition paid to non-public schools.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, that's correct. There's a subtraction for K-12 education expenses and a credit, which we'll get to a little bit later here. The subtraction includes tuition paid to non-public schools. The credit does not. The subtraction amount is limited to $2,500 for, I think that's right. Now I got to look in the longer document because I'm spacing this out. It's a different amount for students in grades K through 6 and students in grades 7 through 12. One of those is $1,625, and the other one is something else.
Thank you.
And I think Ms. Templin will help me find that in this document, and I think I'll just go on and then, she has found it.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's fine, Ms. Manzi. I just wanted to draw a member's attention to that because that can be confusing, and members have asked about that. So I just want to make that clarification. Thank you.
Oh. Thank you, Chair Loon. Ms. Manzi, do you have that number handy there?
Mr. Chair, we left it out of the longer document.
I couldn't find it either as I read this before.
There you go. But I'll get that to you. I think it's $2,500 for students in 7 through 12 and $1,625 for the students in grades K through 6.
Thank you.
I was just going to mention it's on page 13. thank you, Chair Loon. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, when you were going through the tax rates, I was thinking about a conversation, yet another one I had with a constituent the other day regarding why Minnesota just doesn't go to a flat tax. It's difficult to go into that with that explanation, but have you looked at, and this is kind of a general question, other states' attempts at flat tax and the largest hurdles to those, have they been related to any one thing? Specifically, I'm looking at the subsequent slides you talked about in terms of tax expenditures and credits. Has that been the major hurdle to achieving what someone theoretically wants when they say flat tax, or have there been other major problems?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, a number of other states have taxes that are relatively flat compared with Minnesota's taxes. Most states have one or maybe two rates. I think the major hurdle in going from a system like Minnesota has to a flat tax system is that it may sound attractive in the discussion, but then when you start to model the impacts of the tax, then you see that how do we get from, you ask yourself the question, how do we get from here to there? And I think that if we wanted to go from our current four-rate structure to a flat tax and raise the same amount of revenue that we raise with our current law rate structure and continue to allow the same credits and the same subtractions that we allow under current law, so keep the same tax base, our rate would have to be around 7%. Which would be an attractive thing for someone whose last dollar of income is the 7.85% bracket or the 9.85% bracket, but less attractive for someone who is in the 5.35% bracket or even the 7.05% bracket. So that has generally been the sticking point when people consider going to a flat tax, is that you do some estimates of the distribution of the impact of the change, and in order to have there not be a lot of people who ended up paying higher taxes, you would have to change the base and allow a larger family exemption, larger personal and dependent exemptions to get to that, and then you would be reducing the amount of revenue that's raised by the tax, or you would be imposing a rate that would be higher than the 7% rate that would be the revenue neutral rate, more or less.
Thank you, Ms.
Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? Ms. Mann? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a clarification, there was a question on the number on slide 19. As far as the transition from the 7.05% tax rate to the 7.85% tax rate. And I just wanted to draw members' attention to page 7 of the larger handout clarifies that it's a transition from $145,620 to $145,621. So just wanted to clarify.
Thank
you.
Ms. Manz.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Wills, for finding that. So the typo is in the 7.85% box in that table, and we'll correct that before we post it online. As long as we're making clarifications, Ms. Templin did find what those K-12 fraction amounts are, and they are indeed $2,500 for students in grades 7 through 12 and $1,625 for those in grades K through 6.
Ms. Manz.
Okay, I think we had finished with the marriage credit, unless there are any questions about that, and then I will move on to the long-term care credit. This credit equals 25% of premiums paid for long-term care insurance. It's limited to amounts that are not claimed as a federal itemized deduction for medical expenses. The maximum credit is $100 per beneficiary, so a married couple who each have policies could claim a credit of $200. There are just over 60,000 returns projected to claim this credit for tax year 15, and the revenue impact on the state is just over $8 million. Minnesota also allows a credit for past military service that's non-refundable. It's limited to military veterans with 20 years of service or who separated with a disability. The maximum credit is $750. Or your retirement pay. It's phased out for those with incomes over $30,000. So the phase out runs from $30,000 to $37,500. It's at a 10% phase out rate. Just under 2,000 people are projected to claim this credit in tax year 2015, and the revenue impact on the state will be just about $300,000, and I think that's supposed to be for fiscal year 2015. I should mention that all of these revenue estimates for the various credits are taken from the Department of Revenue's most recent tax expenditure budget, which was published last year. That's published every other year, so we won't get a new one of those until next year. The final non-refundable credit is the research credit. This credit is based on a similar federal credit. It's been in existence for a long time for corporate filers. It was extended to individual filers, people who own S corporations, partnerships, or LLCs in tax year 2010. It equals 10% of the first $2 million of qualifying research expenditures, and then 2.5% of any research expenditures over $2 million. The portion of it that goes to individual filers who are owners of S corporations or partnerships, it's just under $14 million in fiscal year 2015. The largest of the refundable credits is the Working Family Credit. It's the state analog to the federal Earned Income Credit. You have to have earnings in order to claim this credit. It's structured as a percentage of earned income. The maximum credit is just over $2,000 for tax year 14. It phases out as income increases over a threshold. The maximum income eligible for a credit for a married couple filing jointly would be just under $50,000 in tax year 14. So you see, it's a credit that extends to a higher income level than you might think. There are a lot of people who claim it, over 300,000 filers in 2013, the last year of actual data. The average credit is just over $600, and the impact on the state is over $200 million in fiscal year 15. This is a refundable credit, so in many cases, the credit a family qualifies for is greater than their liability, and the excess is paid as a check after they file their income tax return. Minnesota also allows a dependent care credit that is somewhat tied to the federal credit. This credit is based on child care expenses of people who pay for child care in order to work or look for work. The maximum credit is $720 if you have one child in child care, $1,440 for two or more children. This one also has an income phase out. The maximum income eligible in tax year 15 is just under $40,000. Over 35,000 filers claimed this credit in 2013, and there was a total amount projected for 2015 of $14.3 million. Like the working family credit, most of this credit is paid as refunds. The final of the three large low-income refundable credits is the K-12 education credit. This equals 75% of eligible K-12 expenses. Expenses that qualify are the same as the expenses for the K-12 subtraction, with the exception of non-public school tuition. The maximum credit is $1,000 per child. It's allowed for an unlimited number of children. So if you have five children in grades K through 12, you could get a $1,000 credit for each child. It has an income-based phase-out that starts at $33,500, and it extends, how far it extends depends on how many children that you claim it for, so the phase-out gets longer and longer and farther up the income range the more children you have. There are about 53,500 claimants in tax year 12, and it's projected to have a revenue impact on the state of $12.9 million in fiscal year 15.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Representative Drazkowski has a question. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, you talked about the working family credit and that you actually have to demonstrate money in order to obtain that. Is there a list of kind of those breakouts in our handouts?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, are you asking about how much earnings you have to have for that?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Ms. Manzi. What is the lower threshold to get in on that? And then what are the variations or striations in law for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I don't think that detail is listed in the handout. There is a House Research short subject publication on the federal income credit and the working family credit. And I'm going to get that on my pile here. There are a lot of short subjects on the House Research website about the income tax. Here it is. Okay. For tax year 15, let's see. And this does not list the income levels. It tells you what the maximum credit is, and it shows what the phase-out threshold is. So I will provide you with that information as to how the credit is structured, just basically to not use the correct number but tell you how it works. It will be a percentage of the first X dollars of earned income, and what X is varies depending on whether you are a household with no children, with one child, or with two or more children. The percentage increases as the number of children increases, as does the maximum income for which you're eligible, the maximum earnings on which that percentage applies. And then there will be sort of a flat area where if you have earnings above that maximum, your credit remains constant. Then you reach a phase-out threshold at which your credit begins to phase out, again by a percentage that varies depending on the number of children in the household. And then the credit goes to zero once the phase-out has fully played out. The phase-out, the maximum income is highest for a married couple with two or more children, and it's lowest for a single filer with no children.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, in regards to the education credit and then the deductions, so a family, a qualifying family, can both qualify for the credit and the deductions. Is that correct?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, a family can, but they cannot claim the credit and the deduction for the same expenses. It generally will be more advantageous to them to claim the credit if they're eligible, because the credit equals 75% of their expenses. So let's say that you had $500 of qualifying expenses for a child in high school for tutoring or for music lessons or something like that, something that qualifies for both the deduction and the credit as opposed to the non-public school tuition. If you were to claim the credit on that $500, you would get 75% of that, which would be $3,750. If you were to claim the deduction on that $500, you would reduce your taxable income for $500 by $500, and you're probably going to be, in order to be income eligible, well, you're probably going to be, if you're income eligible for the credit, either in the 5.35% bracket or the 7.05% bracket. So if you're in the 5.35% bracket, your tax benefit of claiming the deduction for that $500 would be 5.35% of $500, which is something that's much smaller than the $375 that you would get by claiming the 75% credit. So the answer is yes, but you can only claim one or the other for the same expenses.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Manzi. And then lastly, when was the last time that those numbers were increased or with the expenses, the qualifying materials that could be categorized as expenses, and then the deductions? When was the last time that the legislature increased those numbers for Minnesota families?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the credit was enacted in the 1997 K-12 education bill, and it was effective, I think, starting in tax year 1998. The maximum amount for the credit was at the $1,000 at that point when it was enacted. It was first a 100% credit rather than the 75% credit that it is now. Within a few years, there were instances where the Department of Revenue was identifying people who were taking advantage of lower income households who weren't too sophisticated about taxes and offering dubious services for sale of computer hardware and software and tutoring services and having the taxpayers sign over a power of attorney to the provider. And then these taxpayers were unpleasantly surprised when someone else had claimed their tax credit for them based on the power of attorney. And at that point, the Department of Revenue recommended that the legislature reduce the credit to a percentage of expenses, and it was reduced to 75%. I'm not sure of what year that happened in, but it was in the early part of the 2000s. Well, 2001, Ms. Templin tells me, so it was not very long after the credit was enacted. Back to the deduction, at the same time that the credit was enacted in 1997, the legislature also increased the expenses allowed for the deduction. I don't recall what the increase was, but it was a fairly significant increase in the amounts allowed. And that's the last time that the amounts for the deduction were increased. And then the maximum amount for the credit has remained at the $1,000. Of course, when it was first enacted, you had to have $1,000 of expenses to get the $1,000. And now you have to have, I think it's, I'm not going to succeed at doing the math, but it's something over, it's whatever $1,000 is 75% of. You have to spend that much to get the $1,000. The other change that has happened is that when first enacted, the credit was limited to two children, and it was sort of uncapped as far as family size went, with households allowed to claim it for expenses for an unlimited number of children in grades K through 12.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you.
Any other questions at this point from members? Okay, Ms. Manzi.
Okay, there is a credit that is allowed for tax year 2014 only that was enacted in last year's tax bill. It was a proposal that was included in the Senate tax bill. It's a refundable credit for the treatment of reading disorders. It equals 75% of the expenses with a maximum credit of $2,000. The projection for this credit is at just over 6,000 filers and a revenue impact of $2.6 million in fiscal 15. Some of you who were here last year may recall the committee hearing on this. The rationale for allowing it for 1 year only is that the proponents of this credit were also working on changes in the K-12 education system to make it easier for parents to acquire tutoring help and treatment for children with dyslexia and other reading disorders. And they advocated for this credit as sort of a one-year bridge to when they could get better service within the K-12 education system.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi, is some of that now covered by the Affordable Care Act? Do you know?
Ms. Manzi?
Some of these costs for, I'm thinking of vision therapy, for example.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I don't know the answer to that question. Thank
you. Chair Erickson? Okay, Ms. Manzi?
The next refundable credit it's in the income tax chapter. It's administered separately from the income tax. It's often referred to as the combat zone credit. This credit equals $120 for each month that an individual serves in a combat zone during that tax year. It can be claimed by the surviving spouse or dependent child of an individual who's killed in a combat zone. It's claimed by taxpayers who are eligible simply file a form to claim this credit from the department. Since it's a refundable credit, then they would just get a check for this credit, and it's not really administered as part of the income tax. There are about 3,000 individuals who claim this credit each year for an average credit of about $700, and it's about $2.1 million per year. There is a refundable credit for businesses that increase employment in a job Z, which is the Z is for zone, so I hate to say job Z zone, but people think of it as job zone.
Kind of like a hot water heater.
Yeah.
Ms. Manzi?
The credit is 7% of wages paid to an employee in excess of $38,090 up to $126,960. These amounts are indexed each year for inflation. And the credit calculation prohibits payment of the credit to a business that reduces Minnesota employment. The Angel Investment Credit, also known as the Small Business Investment Credit, equals 25% of amounts invested in small businesses up to a maximum credit of $125,000. The business must be located in Minnesota and must be certified by deed as engaged in one of several fields, mostly involving technology. This is a capped credit limited to $15 million per year, and it is in effect through tax year 2016. The final...
Ms. Manzi, was that used up? We wouldn't know. Well, that's for 15. The cap.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if the allocation for tax year 15 has been fully used or not. We could probably look on the deed website and find out. I know that they had begun accepting applications. I happened to be on their website looking for something else earlier this year, and I saw an item saying that they were accepting applications for credits. Those credits are allocated on a first-come, first-served basis. I think that last year their credit amount was fully used up sometime in March. So it may or I'd be a little surprised if it was fully used up already, but maybe it has been.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the final refundable credit is the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit. This matches the federal credit, which equals 20% of the certified cost of rehabilitating a certified historic structure. The credit is claimed by the developer after the property is placed in service. It's administered largely by the State Historic Preservation Officer, which is a unit of the Historical Society. The credit, of course, then will depend on how much property is placed in service in any given year. that in order for the property to qualify, the developer has to follow the rules that are administered by the, I think, the U.S. Department of Interior. I think it's actually maybe part of the National Park Service, and meet all of those qualifications. And when they demonstrate that they've done that, then they get the federal credit of 25% of 20% of their expenses matching the federal credit. The dollar amount for this is a forecasted credit amount. It's projected to be $35.3 million in fiscal 15. Taxpayers may also, or developers may also choose to take this credit as a grant that equals 90% of the credit amount they would have received. That's attractive to developers who are working with nonprofits to develop the property, because those nonprofits might not have tax liability, and it might simply be easier for them to claim it as a grant. This program is sunset after fiscal year 2021.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Any questions for Ms. Manzi on refundable or non-refundable credits? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is more, I just want to touch on something on income tax before she leaves the table, if that's all right.
Sure.
Ms. Manzi, I'm back in one of your earlier slides, and you don't have to go back, but I'm just going to reference it. But we talked about total projected income tax revenue for fiscal year 2015 in the neighborhood of about $10 billion. And my question is about, you know, when you have conversations with constituents about taxes, it often turns to the subject of what they call deductions, or what we often refer to as tax expenditures. And I wonder if you can just highlight the total number of tax expenditures that the state has in statute, in a round number, and perhaps the value of those expenditures, in other words, the amount that the state spends on an annual basis towards that total number of tax expenditures.
Ms. Manzi? Ms. Temple? Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, Ms. Templin was prescient enough to bring this to tax expenditure budget with her, so I'm going to take a quick look at that and see what I find for the individual income tax. A number of these tax expenditures are items that flow through from the federal level, either as exclusions from income or deductions from income. So starting with federal exclusions, fortunately for me, they have them numbered. There are 39 federal exclusions that flow through to the state level. Then federal, what we call above-the-line deductions, which are deductions from adjusted gross income. Adding those brings us, that's 22 more, so that brings us to 61 total. Then they list seven federal deductions. Those would be the itemized deductions for things like mortgage interest and property taxes. So then we get to the Minnesota subtractions, as I talked about. There are eight more of those, bringing us to a total of 77. And then the Minnesota credits bring us to a total of 92 for the individual income tax. I don't think they show a grand total dollar amount here for all of these, and Ms. Templin is shaking her head and saying that they don't. But the document to reference would be the tax expenditure budget. I'll just look through here and highlight for you some of the larger ones than the income tax. Probably the largest one is the federal exclusion for contributions by employers for health insurance. That's over $1 billion in fiscal 15. So taxes, Minnesota, what that means is that Minnesota income tax revenue would be $1 billion higher if we did not allow the exclusion of medical insurance amounts paid by employers. Another big one. Home mortgage interest is $267 million.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi, I don't need you to go through them in
yep.
detail, but I just wanted to point out the fact that there is a large number of them that do add up to a significant amount of money. And I think that when we look at our global picture of what we take in revenue net, that has to be part of the consideration, too. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Simonson.
Yes.
Chair Carlson, I'll pass.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, those tax expenditures, they include the credits that I discussed in my presentation and Minnesota subtractions. I didn't talk in great detail about the federal deductions and exclusions. Those are, you know, as you noted, they're important features of the tax, and they reduce our tax base. And that's a consequence that the state lives with of using federal taxable income as our starting point, is that we then agree to go along with everything that the Congress has decided to allow as an exclusion or a deduction.
Any further questions at this point? Okay, please continue.
Continuing is going to be to...
Mr. Chair, I will start with the next section, sales tax, just in transition as Ms. Dalton comes to the table. On slide 34, it shows that sales tax, the total projected for fiscal 15 from general fund and non-general fund sources is $6.2 billion. Within that amount, there's $734 million from motor vehicle sales tax projected. Sales tax represents about a little less than a third of the total state budget, and businesses pay roughly 42% of the tax. Slide 35 just shows the kind of the overview from fiscal 2005 to fiscal 15 for sales tax revenue and how it's changed. Unlike income taxes, sales tax does not all go into the general fund. Some of it is constitutionally dedicated to other funds, the legacy fund, the motor. Some of it is also dedicated to transportation funds, and Ms. Dalton will go into more detail about that.
Okay, Chair Earhart has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What do you mean by business pays about 42% of the tax? You mean they collect it and return it, or they're actually paying on business products, or what?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, what we mean is those are actual final consumption of purchases of businesses. Some of those are actually inputs. It's, you know, things like office equipment and supplies and things like that. We have exemptions for a lot of manufacturing, but we don't have a whole lot of exemptions for non-manufacturing businesses. So a lot of inputs to non-manufacturing businesses, those businesses are paying sales tax. Computers is a big example.
Chair Earhart.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so you're actually saying that businesses are paying these, not just collecting and returning them to the state.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, that is correct. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why we have sales tax pyramiding, because, of course, these businesses, when they pay sales tax on their inputs, those sales taxes get built into the price of the goods and services that those businesses subsequently sell.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Earhart, Ms. Dalton, can we call it something other than pyramiding, possibly? Let's think of another name. We'll work on that. Okay, members, if we could, we're going to be leaving probably adjourning about 22, because then you'll have a chance to get a snack or a treat before session. So if we could, if it's okay with the committee, if we could go through these slides, because we do need to finish these today, and then we'll ask questions afterwards if that's okay, so that you can turn it on to warp speed here.
Okay.
Not that we're not completely and totally interested in what you're doing.
Okay, I mean, right.
You know, some people, when they say the night before, you know, you're going to do overviews, they go, I'd rather watch paint dry or eat broken glass. I consider this to be a page turner, and we're getting a lot out of it. So please proceed. Ms. Templin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On slide 36, the effective sales tax rate is displayed. And again, this is from the 2013 tax incident report published by the Minnesota Department of Revenue. This shows for five quintiles the sales tax burden as a percent of income and how it steadily falls from 7.5% on the poorest fifth of Minnesota households to 1.8% of income of Minnesota's richest households. And again, you can see it is displayed for consumer purchases and business purchases.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. Mr. Chair, I guess I'm going to take over at this point.
Ms. Dalton?
As Ms. Templin had stated, most of the sales tax revenues go to the general fund, but there are specific parts of the sales tax that are dedicated. There's $734 million of motor vehicle sales tax. 40% of that goes to public transit, and 60% goes to the Highway User Trust Fund. For taxes on motor vehicle leases, which is a separate, it's not part of the motor vehicle sales tax, it's about $69 million. $32 million of it is kept in the general fund, and the rest of it is split between the county state aid program, where that money goes to metro counties except Hennepin and Ramsey, and the other half of it goes to the Greater Minnesota Transit account. There's about $35 million in lottery in-lieu payments. 13% stays in the general fund, and 87% of it is split among various special funds, heritage account, state parks and trails, metro parks and trails, local trails, and a small little bit to the zoos. And then finally, the $295 million from the extra 3.75% legacy sales tax from that amendment, that is also dedicated. And that we have actually a slide on. It's it was effective July 1, 2009. It's in effect for 20 years. It's constitutionally dedicated. You can see there how the money is split between the different funds out there. One thing that's worth noting is that this tax only applies to items that are taxable under the general sales tax law. So if it, something is taxable under Chapter 297A, it's subject to this. If it is not, it is not subject to it. The big one is the motor vehicle sales tax, which is in Chapter 297B. This leads to kind of an interesting anomaly. If you buy your car, you pay a 6.5% motor vehicle sales tax. If you lease your car long term, you will pay a 6.875% tax on your lease. One final thing to note is that if, for some reason, the legislature decides to change the tax base significantly, either expanding it or contracting it, the legislature is allowed under the constitutional amendment to adjust this 3.75 legacy rate. They don't have to. It's not required, but it is something that they're actually allowed to do. So getting back to just rates in general, general rate is 6.875%. Motor vehicle sales tax is 6.5%. We have two other special rates. We have a rate on short-term rental motor vehicles of 21.075%. If you lease a car short-term, which is less than 28 days, that's the tax you will pay. That 21.075% is made up of the general sales tax plus a 9.2% special tax on motor vehicles, plus a 5% fee that actually goes to the people who are renting the vehicle to you to reimburse them for their motor vehicle registration tax. The reason that manufactured housing and park trailers also only pays the sales tax on 65% of the costs, and that's to make them roughly comparable to the amount of sales tax that's built into new housing construction, because new housing pays sales tax on all of their building materials, but they don't pay it on the labor. So that's what. Sales tax base. The way to think about the sales tax base in Minnesota, it's supposed to be a sales tax on final consumption. As we said earlier, 42% of it, however, is actually paid by business. Generally, goods, personal property are taxable unless specifically exempted. So if there isn't an exemption for something that you can hold in your hands, it's probably taxable. Services and intangibles are usually not taxed unless they are specifically included. And examples are lodging, services like cleaning services, telecommunications. One of the big ones that just was enacted recently is we now tax digital downloads. So we tax, you know, your iTunes and your Amazon Prime video downloads and things like that. Major exemptions for individuals. The two biggest ones in this state are food for home consumption and clothing. We also exempt home heating fuels, which can include electricity and natural gas during the heating months, not year-round, but just during the heating months. Motor fuels, which are subject to the gas tax, they're not subject to sales tax. All drugs for human consumption are tax-exempt. Newspaper and subscription magazines are exempt. And cigarettes are exempt from sales tax, but they are pay an in-lieu tax instead. The major business and farm sales tax exemptions. We exempt capital equipment for manufacturing, mining and industrial purposes. We exempt farm machinery. Capital equipment is kind of an interesting one. That was originally a exemption where you had to pay the tax up front and then you had to apply for a refund. That has recently been changed with a delayed effective date. As of June 30th of 2015, this will be an upfront exemption. People will no longer have to pay it and then file for the refund on capital equipment.
Thank you, Chair Lucheski.
Farm machinery is exempt. Direct inputs to agricultural and industrial production are exempt, and direct inputs to some of the taxable services are exempt. Things that businesses still continue to pay are on things like office equipment and furniture, computers, and equipment for all taxable services. There's no exemption if you're providing a taxable service for any of your equipment. And inputs to most non-manufacturing businesses like the lodging industry and things like that, they continue to pay sales tax on all their inputs. Other major sales tax exemptions, we do not tax sales to the federal government. We're constitutionally prohibited from doing that. We've gone back and forth. Most recently, in 1991, we started taxing sales to all local governments except for school districts, and there's been an attempt to get that changed back for many, many years, and in 2013 that was actually repealed. So counties, cities, towns, school districts, and hospitals are no longer subject to the sales tax. Special districts and joint powers organizations will no longer be subject to the tax beginning in 2016, and the Met Council will be exempt from the tax beginning in 2017. I say must sales because there is one big issue. The two big areas where local governments continue to pay sales tax is on building materials and on their regular motor vehicle purchases. They're exempt on fire trucks and police cars, but not on the car for the mayor to run around in. Most sales to a number of nonprofit charitable organizations are exempt. And get on my page so I can actually tell you which ones they are. Any nonprofit that provides charitable, religious, or educational functions, if they serve kids or seniors, there's some exemptions for purchases by veterans groups. And then there are certain sales made by nonprofit charitable organizations that are also exempt, things like YMCA, YWCA, JCC admissions, limited fundraising by kids. Your Boy Scouts and your Girl Scouts don't have to go collect the sales tax. Certain nonprofit arts admissions and some specific fundraising activities. One of the topics that gets talked about a lot is the sales tax and remote sales. The state cannot constitutionally require remote sellers to collect the sales tax. It violates the Commerce Clause. Because of that, this state is probably losing, the last estimate in 2011 was $200 million of sales tax that's not being collected because remote sellers don't have to collect their tax. To address that, Minnesota with, and it says 21 and it's actually 23 other states, have joined into an organization called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. You're also going to hear about that a lot because it is an attempt to essentially standardize sales tax administration and definitions across states in an effort either to get Congress to overturn the court cases and essentially impose a duty to collect on remote sellers who have simplified their taxes, or alternatively, maybe at some point, actually go back and litigate and say, if we've simplified as much as we have, do we really violate the Commerce Clause anymore? So there are a number. Minnesota was one of the first states to adopt the streamlined sales tax agreements, and there are a number of things that we can and cannot do under that agreement. So often if people are looking at doing sales tax exemptions, that will be one of the questions that's raised, is that allowed under streamlined sales tax? Very briefly, local sales taxes. Local sales taxes will probably be heard in the property tax division first, but you will see them all eventually. There's a general prohibition against local sales and income taxes, which was enacted in 1971 as part of the Minnesota Miracle. The very first local, that means all the local taxes were essentially had to come to the all the cities who wanted one had to come to the legislature and ask for a special law allowing them. The first one was Duluth in 1973, Rochester in 1983, Minneapolis in 1986. There were a few more in the 90s, and then we had a very big influx of them beginning in about 2005. There are currently 28 of them imposed. If you want to see a list of who's got them, it's on pages 34 and 35. Of the big handout. The big change in local sales taxes is that there were two statutory authorities actually enacted in 2008 to allow the Seven County Metro area to impose a transit area tax. Five of those counties in the Seven County Metro area imposed it. They were allowed to do it just by board approval as opposed to voter approval. The other thing passed in 2008 was statute that allowed any other county to impose up to a half-cent sales tax for a specific transportation or transit project. That required voter approval. Nobody approved one. In 2013, that law was modified to allow it to be used for a few more things and also allowed to have it approved just by the county board as opposed to going to the voters via referendum. There are, as of January 1, there are now seven counties that impose a county transportation tax, and they are also listed on those pages. And with that, if there are any questions.
Well, before we go to questions, why don't we go through the rest of this and then we'll open up the questions, because I do want to get through this today if we can. So don't go too far away, Ms. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, again, transitioning to corporate taxes on slide 47, I will just start with the tax incident slide. Again, this slide shows how what economists would describe as a regressive tax. The burden falls from at the first quintile from 0.7% to 0.2% for the top fifth quintile, and that is the end of the tax incident slides.
Turning to the Joel Michael from House Research. Turning to the corporate franchise tax, the tax base for this tax is essentially the income or the profits of C corporations. And C corporations are, of course, those corporations that are not S corporations. And the corporate franchise tax also doesn't apply to LLCs or partnerships, what are we usually refer to as pass-through entities. The federal law requires essentially almost all publicly traded companies to be C corporations. So if their stock is traded on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or something like that, they will be C corporations. There's a few exceptions for what are called master limited partnerships that are usually pipelines and other energy kind of companies. But otherwise, the main tax base for this is the income of publicly traded corporations. Obviously, most of them have multi-state operations, so then the next question is, how do you determine how much of their income is fairly apportionable or attributable to Minnesota? And we now do that based on what percentage of their total sales are made to buyers who are located in Minnesota. We now use 100% sales. For the last 8 years, we were slowly transitioning to using only sales. The tax rates, 9.8%, that's one of the highest tax rates in the country for corporate taxes, but we have other rules that are more favorable that partially offset that. There are credits allowed for R&D, for taxes paid to other states for Jobs E, and for the historic credit which Nina described in the individual income tax. It's the same. You can claim it on the corporate tax, and you can claim it against the insurance premium tax, too. There's a minimum fee that applies, and this is the one part of the corporate franchise tax that does apply to S corporations and partnerships, flow-through entities. The tax raises about $1.4 billion for fiscal 15 is the current projection. The thing to note about the revenue from this tax is that it is very volatile. It is the most volatile of our major revenue sources. The slide you see there sort of illustrates that. The larger handout has a bigger table that goes through some of the effects. When the economy goes into recession, obviously one of the things that happens is the profits of big publicly traded corporations go way down, and so they pay less tax as a result. It's not unusual to have 50 to 100% swings in revenue.
Just really quickly, Mr. Chair, here is another tax incidence slide. This is for other, for excise taxes. That includes fuel, cigarette, and liquor taxes. And since this is looking at 2010 data, it included the health impact fee, which has been repealed. Excise taxes, as you can see from the slide, are some of what economists would call regressive taxes, because in the first quintile, which is the poorest fifth of Minnesota households, it's 3.2%, and the burden falls to 0.3% for the fifth quintile. Mr. Chair, the next slide shows the percent of taxes paid, and this shows how the fifth quintile, which is the richest fifth of Minnesota households, pays the largest share of the of total excise taxes at 28.3%.
The next major tax, and we've ordered these by the amount of revenue they raise, the next major tax is the motor fuels tax. This is obviously, people talk about it as the gas tax. It's a 28.5% tax. There are really two components of that. There's a basic 25 cent per gallon tax, and then there's a debt service surcharge that adds another 3.5 cents per gallon. Thing to note about this tax, obviously, which is getting discussed a lot now, is that it's a per unit tax set as a fixed dollar amount. So as you know, the number of gallons consumed declines or increases, revenues increase. As inflation increases or changes or price changes, this tax does not change, so it does not grow with inflation, and it doesn't shrink when the price of gas drops either, for that matter. In fact, that may increase revenues because people will consume more gas and pay more tax. Revenues by the Constitution are required to go to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. The name there is incorrect. It's the local governments receive a share of that. There's a separate county and a municipal state aid street fund. It's projected to raise a little under $900 million for fiscal 15. Cigarette and tobacco tax. Again, this is a per unit tax, so it's set as a number of, actually, and if you look in the statute, mils per cigarette. Tax rate is currently $2.90 per a pack of 20. For tobacco products, where we're talking about snuff, chewing tobacco, pipe tobacco, etc., it's 95% of the wholesale price. So in the tobacco tax, it's actually scaled to the price of the product, so it will change with inflation. One thing that the 2013 tax bill did, aside from increasing the cigarette tax by a substantial amount, it also indexed that tax rate for inflation. So as the price of cigarettes change, and this is based on the Department of Revenue gathering data and estimating what the average price of all cigarettes, retail price of all cigarettes in Minnesota for the past year were, then they increase the tax rate based on what that price change was, or they decrease it if there would miraculously be a reduction in cigarette prices. That caused a 7-cent increase this month in the cigarette tax. So it went from $2.83 for a pack of 20 to $2.90 a pack. Taxes estimated to raise about $641 million for fiscal 15, and that includes there is a non-settlement fee that's imposed on that shows down there 50 cents per pack on cigarettes that are produced by manufacturers that were not part of the agreement with the state. So the big manufacturers like Altria and RJ R, Lower Lard, etc., they entered an agreement with the state. There's a bunch of small manufacturers, some of whom which sprang up in response to the settlement. They have to pay a 50 cent per pack fee, and that raises about $3 million in revenue. Alcoholic excise taxes, these also, like the other excise taxes, are set as a dollar amount per unit of the beverage. Tax varies by the type of beverage. The highest applies to liquor or distilled spirits at over $5 a gallon. The wine tax is 30 cents a gallon for table wine. And for strong beer, the beer that comprises the vast, vast majority of the market, it's about 15 cents a gallon. The thing to note is none of this is scaled to the amount of alcohol in the beverage. The federal excise tax is explicitly imposed on the alcoholic content. Minnesota taxes are just based on the amount of fluid that's in the beverage. It's projected to raise $85 million. There's also a gross receipts tax on alcohol sales. This used to be part of the sales tax, but streamlined required us to make it a separate tax. It's really the easiest way to think about it is it's another retail sales tax. That's at a 2.5% rate, raises about the same amount of revenue as the excise tax that's imposed on distributors at the wholesale level.
Mr. Chair, on slide 61, we see another tax incidence slide for other state taxes. These taxes, the first quintile has the largest burden at 2.75%, and the top quintile, or the fifth quintile, pays 0.7%. These other taxes would be considered regressive by economists. I should note that the other taxes include motor vehicle license tax and insurance taxes. The percent of taxes paid, the fifth quintile pays the largest share of total taxes for this group at 41.1%.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. Mr. Michael.
The next tax we're going to cover is the motor vehicle license tax, or the registration tax. This people oftentimes refer to it as the tab fee. And there are basically two components of this tax. There's a minimum dollar amount. There's a $35 that you pay without regard to what kind of vehicle you're talking about. But then if 1.25% of the base value of the vehicle, and that's based on the manufacturer's base value less a depreciation factor depending upon how old the vehicle is, if that would yield a higher amount, then you pay the higher amount. And a little interesting sidelight is the part of the tax that's based on value is tax deductible. whereas the part of the tax that's based on the minimum is not tax deductible. There's probably a lot of people that deduct the whole amount. The revenue from this...
Kind of an oops there, I think, maybe.
The revenues from this, by the Constitution, are required to go to the Highway User Tax Distribution Trust Fund that, again, is shared with counties and cities as well as the Trunk Highway Fund, and this is projected to raise a little under $700 million for fiscal 15. Minnesota Care Taxes, the tax base for this tax is the gross revenues of health care providers. The tax rate is 2%, so this is basically a gross revenue or gross receipts tax on health care providers. So it applies to hospitals, it applies to surgical centers, it applies to physicians, it applies to psychologists and all these other more minor types of health care providers. Medicare and the federal employee health programs are exempt from it. Revenues go into the health care fund and are used to pay for the Minnesota Care Fund. This tax is set now to sunset in 2020, and it's projected to raise about $550 million for fiscal 15. The insurance premiums tax is a tax that's based on gross premiums. Simple way to sort of think about this is it's really like a sales tax on insurance purchases. Basic tax rate is 2%. There are lower tax rates that apply to certain other types of insurance. There are mutual, township mutuals are exempt, and there's a grandfather provision that exempts one mutual, effectively exempts one mutual company, or not as an exempt, but it imposes a lower tax rate. Life insurance pays a lower tax rate of 1.5%, so the 2% rate basically applies to property and casualty. 1% applies to HMOs and nonprofit health service plan corporations. That's the name for Blue Cross. And that money goes into the health care access fund, the money from the HMO and Blues tax. One of the very important features about the insurance premium tax is that there's a retaliatory tax. Federal law has exempted states' insurance taxes from the Commerce Clause, and this allows states to have provisions that effectively discriminate against taxes imposed by other states. And what almost all states have done, including Minnesota, is to say that if you being some other state, tax our local companies more heavily on the business that they sell in your state, we will tax your companies at the same rate that you taxed our companies at. That has some important effects for your ability to make changes in the insurance tax, because we in Minnesota are fortunate enough to have a bunch of insurance companies that are headquartered, domiciled here, that sell a fair amount of insurance in other states. And if we were to raise our tax so that it would be higher than what is imposed in many other states, our insurance companies who are domiciled here would then find that that rate increase not only affected the insurance they were selling here, but the insurance that they were selling in other states that have lower rates than ours, because those states would then retaliate against us and say, look, when your companies are selling insurance in our state, they're going to have to pay the rate that you impose and not the lower rate that we impose. So that's an important consideration when you think about changing our insurance tax. And if you reduce our insurance tax, that may cause retaliatory tax that's imposed on our companies in other states that have lower taxes than ours to go down. And that was the reason why the life insurance tax was reduced to 1.5%, was to help our local life insurance companies. Fiscal 15 revenues are about $440 million. The estate tax is largely based on federal definitions. For many years, it was only a pure pickup tax, so there didn't affect anybody. Didn't increase their tax; it just reduced their federal tax and redirected some of that money to the Minnesota Treasury rather than to the federal Treasury. The tax is deductible now in computing the federal estate tax, but it's that credit is gone. It was repealed by the first round of the Bush tax cuts. The tax base is largely the market value of the state, the amount of property that the individual owned at the date of death, or trusts that were controlled by the decedent. Transfers to surviving spouses are exempt. Charitable bequests are exempt. And there's an exemption amount of $1.4 million that applies in 2015. And under changes enacted in 2014, that will gradually increase by $200,000 per year to $2 million in 2018. There are also exemptions for qualified small business and farm properties that allow the total exemption to increase to $5 million. So that amount is $5 million less whatever the general exemption is. Tax rates range from 9% to 16%, and gifts that are made within 3 years of death and that are taxable at the federal level, so they're over the $14,000 annual exemption amount, are pulled back into the estate. Tax is estimated to raise $160 million in fiscal 15. This, again, is a very volatile revenue source. If some very wealthy person dies, we'll get a lot of revenue. So, for example, if you look at the slide there, in 1 year we got $216 million. Over $100 million of that was attributable to one estate. And there are other years when not many people die and we don't collect much revenue. So on the slide you can see that 1 year we only collected $50 million in 2001. 31 states do not have estate or inheritance taxes, so Minnesota is one of 19 that does. This is, in terms of progressivity, this is the most progressive of our general taxes. One concern that people have is, because so many states do not have estate and inheritance taxes, is that causing people to change their domicile to avoid the Minnesota tax, to change so that they'll claim their domiciles in Nevada or Florida or some other place. Mortgage registry tax is imposed on the principal debt that's secured by a mortgage on real property in Minnesota. The rate's 0.23% of whatever the debt amount is. It's collected by the lender when the loan is closed, and it's paid to the county treasurer, and the county then remits 97% of the revenue back to the state and keeps 3% for the county. This is projected to raise about $90 million in fiscal 15. Obviously, this is a tax that's also very sensitive to the amount of mortgage activity that's going on. So if interest rates go up and people stop borrowing money, the revenues will go down. When interest rates are high but then go down and a lot of people refinance, you'll collect a lot more revenue. There will be some years when this raises $150 million and other years when it raises $70 million. Deed transfer tax is imposed on the value of deeds that are transferred, including contracts for deed when they're actually executed. The rate's 0.33% of the consideration for the transfer. It's paid by the person who transferred the property, again, to the county treasurer, collected at the county level, remitted to the state, with the county keeping 3%. And for the projections for fiscal 15 are about $90 million. So for this year, this is not, this is sort of an unusual case where the mortgage and the deed tax are both projected to raise about the same amount of money. And that's it.
Well, I would like to thank Ms. Manzi, Ms. Dalton, Ms. Templin, and Mr. Michael. Thank you very much. We're going to have one quick question first here. And then before we get to that question, I was advising my clients that the best year to die was probably 2010. Now, there was no federal tax, because I said, if you're not feeling well, December of 10 versus January of 11. But what did the state of Minnesota do at that time in 10? Did we follow the feds or did we do our own?
Mr. Chair, we've had an estate tax. Our estate tax has never gone away. The federal tax, as you suggest, for 1 year, went away. Then Congress reenacted it and let people opt out of it.
I mean, we as financial planners have to give good advice, so that's what I was advising. Representative Barrett, and then we will go for lunch.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, a quick comment more than a question, but I think it's worth noting, you know, going back to the motor vehicle fuels tax, you know, it's 28 cents a gallon. We're 16th in the country, so 16th highest in the country in that. But when you look at how many miles we drive per capita, we're actually 5th in the country. So you have to combine the two because volume plus rate equals dollars received. So we're pretty high in miles per capita, which makes our gas tax fairly high as a total number. And a lot of the states that have a higher gas tax than us are states that people don't necessarily drive that much, New York and other eastern states that provide on other types of transportation. So I just wanted to mention that to the committee for what it's worth.
Thank you, Chair Earhart, and then we'll wrap it up here.
We also have the third to the fifth highest road miles in the country. So if anybody also bring that into consideration, we have more stuff to take care of.
Thank you very much, Chair Hart. Now, again, I'd like to thank Ms. Manzi, Dalton, Templin, and Mr. Michael. Thank you very much, and I would just suggest to the committee members, as you know, if you've been around here a while, these are very important people to get to know. With that, good government all the time. We're adjourned.